Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with scholar Elaine Pagels about her new study of the Book of Revelation.
What is going on here? There's a seven-headed red beast, and there's the Whore of Babylon, and there's the Battle of Armageddon. It reads like a mythological scenario.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Zbigniew Brzezinski walks us through the complicated strategic problems facing the United States.
Global power involves struggle for hegemony, and the last phase in it was a struggle between America and the Soviet Union.
Biographer Ann Seba discusses the surprising life of that other woman, Wallis Simpson.
Jewelry was the really corrosive element in this whole story.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Elaine Pagels is one of America's most distinguished scholars of religion and also the author of prize-winning and best-selling books. Her new one is a very important book. It's called Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. It's reviewed for us this week by Dale Martin, who says one of the many benefits of Pagels' book is its demonstration of the unpredictability of apocalyptic politics, something on many people's minds today.
Yes.
I'm delighted that Elaine is here to discuss her book. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
All right. So the title of the book is Revelations, but we're really talking about the Book of Revelation. Who wrote it and when and why?
Yes, many people get that title wrong, but it's about the Book of Revelation. It's written probably at the end of the first century by a Jewish prophet named John, who's a follower of Jesus. We don't know much about him. Later, people thought he was one of Jesus' disciples, but that's probably not the same John. And he wrote this book because he was passionately concerned about what happened to his people, the Jewish people, when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem in the Jewish War that had happened about 20 years earlier.
So in writing this book, first, who is his audience? Who does he imagine he'll be reaching? And second, what argument does he make?
Probably he's writing to other followers of Jesus. And the question that he and, you know, everyone would have been asking is, how could God allow such terrible things to happen on earth? And what his book does is talk about the fact that the world is caught in a battle between the forces of good and the forces of evil. The forces of evil have seemed to win. In this case, he means the Romans, but it could mean any forces of evil. But eventually, God is going to intervene and stop the forces of evil, fight them at the Battle of Armageddon and win and bring justice back to earth.
So that is the story John tells.
That's right.
What about the story of reaction and reception and history of this very famous book?
Well, you know, what I wanted to do was not just look at the story John tells, which is made it one of the most popular books in the Bible, although it's a very strange one, but who wrote, why did he write this book? Why did he write it this way? What was he trying to do? And then how have people managed to read the same book for 2,000 years as if their own conflicts and struggles could be plugged into this story that he tells about the end time, the judgment day, the apocalypse?
Well, you talk about good and evil, the power of a huge empire. Don't we hear language like this right now in our own moment?
We do. And we, I mean, you can also hear it in fiction like Star Wars or Lord of the Rings, but you also hear it from, you know, from politicians about forces of good and forces of evil. Of course, whoever is telling the story thinks they're on the force side of good. And it's a way of picturing conflict as though whatever conflict you're in, you're on the side of God and the other people are on the side of evil. And it's a very powerful and moving book. I've developed a lot of respect for it, but I started out with very mixed feelings because many people think they know exactly what this book is prophesying right now.
And what about John as author or writer? I mean, he must have been an extraordinarily gifted man of words to create this document that resonates right up to the present. Do we know much about him?
We don't know much about him, but what the book consists of is really visions. You know, it's all dreams and nightmares. That's why on one level it's hard to read because you think, what is going on here? There's a seven-headed red beast and there's the Whore of Babylon and there's the Battle of Armageddon. It reads like a mythological scenario. But on the other hand, you know, a five-year-old can hear it because it is a very simple narrative about a clash between good and evil in which finally good wins. But I was also interested in who was reading this book. Why did they love it?
And who was reading it?
Lots of people. And when it was first written, it was read by Jews and followers of Jesus who were being persecuted by the Roman Empire because they were followers of a seditionist. If Jesus was crucified for treason against Rome, he probably wasn't guilty of that, but that's what the Romans thought. They thought he was trying to be a Jewish king and throw out the Romans. And so anyone who was his follower was suspect. His followers like Peter was crucified. His follower Paul was beheaded. Jesus' brother James was lynched in Jerusalem. So his followers were up against an empire that was absolutely ruthless and would kill its citizens with impunity, like some we've seen now. So he wanted to write a book and say, the Lord has told me, in the language of the prophets of Israel, that he won't allow injustice forever, and, you know, he's going to come and avenge it, and don't worry, hope is on the way. God will prevail.
Now, Elaine, he's writing in the ancient world long, long before there's a printing press, and there's almost no literacy, or there's a very tiny portion of the population
right.
that can read it all. How did the message then spread through the ancient world?
Great question. He was somebody who could write Greek well, and that was the language, sort of the English of the ancient world.
That's the language people knew in different
countries.
Yeah,
even though his first language was either Aramaic or Hebrew. But what people probably did is they took these prophecies, you know, these visions, and they memorized them, or enough, and then they would go around and preach them from one place to the other, and they would preach them in a service, and you can hear call and response from the congregation in this very Revelation text.
No, wait, how do you know that that's what you're hearing? Is that what you do as a literary scholar? You interpret the language in that way so you know it's a call and response?
Well, you can see it in the last chapter. You know, he says, the prophet speaks in the words of Jesus, and he says, this is what Jesus said to me. After he was dead, of course, he's alive again. It's not Jesus of Nazareth. It's a vision he has of the risen Jesus. So Jesus speaks, and he says, look, I'm coming soon, you know, sort of hold on, endure till the end, and you'll be saved. And then the congregation says, yes, come, Lord Jesus. And they think of Jesus as Israel's Messiah, and he's coming soon to transform the world.
Elaine, you've said that John was probably a Jew. This is a text, a book of the Bible that really that Christians have embraced. Does it speak to Christianity in a very particular way?
Well, it does in the sense that John was a follower of Jesus, but the reason I don't call him a Christian is that he never uses the word, and he probably would have thought it didn't apply to him, because it was a word that was used of non-Jews, Gentiles, who were converted. And this movement was still, for a lot of followers of Jesus, within a Jewish community. So it's right before Christianity becomes a breakaway religion, and that's part of the fascination of this story.
And over time, in recent centuries, what are the particular interpretations people have placed on Revelation? You say it has this language that's very rich and elusive, but it also can be understood in some way or grasped by almost anyone. Are there particular ways people took assertions of John and said, well, he's talking about this right now?
Right. And, I mean, there are stories about angels fighting, you know, demonic forces and so forth. And there are very specific allusions John has. He has a seven-headed beast with seven heads and crowns on its head that probably refers to the emperors of Rome. Mm-hmm. But then it can be interpreted later in the 10th and 11th century as Christians battling for the Holy Land against Muslims who controlled it. It was read in the 15th century as by Catholics against Protestants. I mean, Martin Luther's friends said, the Pope is the whore of Babylon.
Right. And that became a very common expression for the Roman Catholic Church, wasn't it?
It did, among Protestants. And among Catholics, Luther was seen as the seven-headed monster. Mm. So this language, that's what I mean, it can be used on both sides. In the American Civil War, it was used on the northern side in the Battle Hymn of the Republic. That language comes straight out of the book of Revelation. People saw the horrible carnage of the Civil War as evidence that the end time was coming and the world was being punished for the sin of slavery on the northern side. The southerners said, it's the North that's the beast, the monster, and we're going to win. And so,
and someone like John Brown, the abolitionist,
yes,
is essentially making a kind of argument from Revelation, isn't he, about sin and
absolutely
corruption?
And so, and actually so is Lincoln to some extent, and so are the people on the other side. That's what I realized. Even in World War II, many people saw Hitler as the beast, and that fits because he's sort of seen as a ruling power who's embodiment of evil. But there were people on the Nazi side who were pumping up Christian propaganda with the Book of Revelation that Hitler was bringing in the thousand-year reign of Christ. The war in Iraq also, you saw this book brought in because it really talks about powerful and conflict fought to the death.
And Elaine, what about the great literary heritage? We think of writers like John Milton or William Blake, visionary, and also religious writers. Do they also draw on the Book of Revelation?
Oh, completely. Milton and Dante. And what struck me also are the artists. I mean, there's a tremendous pictorial representation from Bosch to Blake to Michelangelo to many fine contemporary artists are also using it. It's, of course, it's been used in film a lot too, and poetry. So this book is can also be open to the imagination, to symbolic interpretation, and that's one way it survives.
Thanks so much, Elaine.
Thank you.
That's Elaine Pagels, whose new book, Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation, is reviewed in this week's Book Review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So every ambitious, aspiring writer's dream comes true. That novel in the drawer, and finally you make it big. Tell us about it.
In this case, it was five novels in the drawer. But this is the story of what happens when a writer writes in secret without putting much stock in whether or not her books are published. And the answer in this case is that you'll be published. It might not happen for 25 years, though. And that's what happened to Charlotte Rogan, who is the author of a literary novel that just came out this week called The Lifeboat. And Charlotte spent a lot of time living in Dallas, the mother of triplets who are now in college. And the whole time that she was raising her kids and doing other things that had nothing to do with writing, she was sitting around at home and spending a few hours a day writing her novels.
And so she decided, you said it was done almost in secret, but obviously she did want them published. Did she show them all to her publisher or just one? Or what's the deal here?
Well, she spent a lot of her time when she was writing kind of turning down invitations to lunch because that was her writing time. She told very few friends that she was interested in writing. And in fact, nothing about her background indicated that she was a writer. She studied architecture at Princeton as an undergrad in the early 70s. She did some work in engineering. She did some work for architecture firms. And she was married to a lawyer who had a lot of big, heavy criminal law texts in the home library. And that was really how she became interested in what became The Lifeboat. She was looking around in some criminal law texts and found a couple of cases of old seafaring murders. And one of these cases, which dated back to the 19th century, was called Queen versus Dudley and Stevens. And it was a story of cannibalism and murder on a lifeboat. And that was really how she got started thinking about her own novel, The Lifeboat, which she started working on in about 1999 and just finished a couple of years ago.
Now, you mentioned some other novels.
Yes, The Lifeboat was actually the fourth novel that Charlotte wrote. The fifth novel was called Security, and it was the story of people in a gated community. And she wrote this when she was living in Dallas during the George W. Bush administration, and as she said, feeling a little bit outnumbered politically. So that was a little bit of a secret novel as well, because she didn't think she should bring it up among her Dallas friends.
And will that be published too? Or don't we know?
We don't think so. One thing that Charlotte said was that she was glad that her earlier work has never been published and that she didn't really try very hard to get it in the hands of a publisher. The way that the Lifeboat ended up finding its way to an editor was when Charlotte happened to be talking to someone who had a connection to an agent, and she took one of the books, not the Lifeboat, and then threw in the Lifeboat as kind of a whim and sent both books to this agent. And it turned out that the agent just loved the Lifeboat, sent it to an editor at Little Brown who adored it and bought it immediately.
Well, that's a heartening story. So I guess the moral here is, if you're married to a big-time lawyer, pass up some lunch appointments. Maybe you can write your novel, too.
It's a true late bloomer story and an inspiring one. But one thing that, Charlotte did say is that it may have helped take the pressure off to not always be talking about the novel that she was working on and when it might be published and what this agent or what this editor said. She said there were times when just the writing of it was enough.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Zbigniew Brzezinski is one of the most respected and prolific experts on foreign policy in the United States today. He was a former national security advisor. Now he's both a professor at Johns Hopkins and a worldwide authority. He has a new book called Strategic Vision, America and the Crisis of Global Power. It's reviewed on our cover by Jonathan Friedland, who says Professor Brzezinski is a heavy hitter who discusses both the dangers of America's decline and also strategies for its recovery and survival. And I'm delighted Professor Brzezinski is here to talk about his book. Welcome.
It's good to be with you.
What is the crisis of global power that faces America today?
The crisis of global power is not necessarily a crisis of America as such, although, in my view, our domestic problems, not well handled, and our foreign policy errors, particularly over the last decade, have contributed to the crisis of America's global power. But global power, and this is a key point, is itself undergoing fundamental change. Namely, till now, and for the last 500 years, global power involves struggle for hegemony. And the last phase in it was a struggle between America and the Soviet Union. The crisis of global power in our time is that no one power, in my view, is likely to be hegemonic. And as a consequence, the challenge we now face is either to shape a wider and more balanced framework for international cooperation, particularly on the huge Eurasian continent where most power is centered, or we'll face in this century increasingly global turmoil.
And what are the steps America can realistically take to get the better outcome that you describe?
In addition to coping with its domestic problems, which is saying a lot in a short phrase, I think we ought to strive very deliberately to create, first of all, a wider Euro-Atlantic community, which would embrace, perpetuate, and peacefully promote the good values that the West stands for, namely constitutional democracy, governmental systems subject to law and to democratic choice, a Euro-Atlantic community which would embrace not only an America and Europe, a reality with which we're familiar and which NATO to some extent represents, but also try to embrace in that community two additional key participants who are geographically adjoining, namely Turkey, which has been engaged now for 100 years in steadily democratizing and modernizing itself, and Russia, which is yet to move forward in those directions in a decisive fashion, but which I do expect that before too long, Russia too will be mature and ready for genuine partnership within the Euro-Atlantic community.
Professor Brzezinski, when you assess or examine America's diplomatic and foreign policy strategy and vision now, was there, and compare it to previous eras, let's say the great period at the beginning of the Cold War, when America found a way to form important alliances and represent major democratic values. Has a political failure occurred at somewhere along the line? Do we no longer have the sense we once did of the role we should play and understand the means for doing it?
I think that's a critically important question. I think there has been failure, particularly and tragically, in the wake of America's success in the Cold War. We emerged preeminent, but I'm afraid, particularly under our most recent previous president, George Bush II, we embarked on a policy which was unilateral in its military dimensions, short-sighted, and as a consequence, we have increasingly faced prolonged and badly conducted wars that have been debilitating to our interests. I think, however, the interesting challenge that we face today, and which I've already described, is in some ways similar to the challenge to which you have alluded and which President Truman faced when the Cold War started. He was imaginative enough to shape a new alliance between America and Europe for the defense of the West. I think today President Obama has the chance to reach out, especially since he understands so well the new global realities that no one power can be hegemonic, to reach out to potential partners in the West, and I've already mentioned the two that I have particularly in mind, Turkey and eventually Russia, but also at the same time to strive to reach a partnership with China in the Far East while promoting a Chinese-Japanese reconciliation and while avoiding any alliances against China on the Asian mainland. I think such a policy would go a long way in responding to the new reality that the challenge these days is not a central nuclear war, as it was during some phases of the Cold War, but how to deal with global problems if old traditional conflicts and instabilities degenerate into turmoil.
Dr. Brzezinski, you mentioned earlier, and our reviewer Jonathan Friedland notes, that you also discuss America's domestic political problems, the great economic crisis. What do we need to do, and how does that relate to our foreign policy? Why are they connected?
They're connected because part of America's strength in the world has been the special appeal, the unique appeal of the American dream. I think that has waned considerably, and reviving some elements of that dream is an enormous challenge, but also a necessary one. Unfortunately, we now have a financial system that is dominated by greed, operates largely by speculation, which produces enormous personal fortunes unrelated to any job creation, and is resulting in a social system marked by increasing disparities in wealth, all of which can be very dangerous in the long run to social cohesion. And we also have a permissive society in which some fundamental norms of social organization are being undermined, such as, for example, the centrality of the family unit in creating a well-focused and responsive new generations. I think these are the kind of long-term problems which will need to be addressed, but they cannot be addressed while we ignore the rest of the world, and we cannot focus on the rest of the world while ignoring this problem. So there's an interaction.
And how many of these problems, or which in particular, can be solved through political choices Americans make. Some of these almost sound as if they're aspects of a broader cultural moral decline or transfer of values that would be, it's almost hard to imagine how even the most visionary leader could affect a change there.
You're quite right. And I think one of the problems that we confront right now is a political system that is simultaneously polarized and gridlocked. And also, and I hate to say this, increasingly showing signs of corruption by money. It will require a real act of will, an extraordinary articulation for a new president. Actually, I think Obama still is the one that can do it best, to make the American people aware of the scale of the problem. I frankly think that the president, and particularly if Obama is reelected, and I say this unabashedly, even though occasionally in the past I've supported Republicans, I think Obama is in a position to really start addressing the American people on a regular basis about the state of the world and its interrelationship with our domestic problems, and the other way around as well. Because our public right now is so badly informed about the world that it really makes the adoption of a rational and effective foreign policy very difficult.
You say that we're so badly informed, and yet, in the great period that you referred to when Truman was president and through that period of consensus politics, was the American public in some way more mature or more serious-minded than it is today?
No, neither. But what was very different is that the threat then was very clear-cut, very easy to define, very specific, even if potentially global in its consequences. There was a specific enemy and a specific challenger and a very odious doctrine threatening us. Part of the problem today is complexity. And the public, I think, in America really does not understand very well. And there are plenty of public opinion polls which illustrate this. What are the key problems facing this world and what they imply for a country like America, without whose participation in dealing with the problems of the world, it is unlikely that these problems will ever be effectively addressed. So while I do not believe that we can again be hegemonic, as we seemed briefly capable of becoming after the victory over the Soviet Union, we still need, desperately need, and the world needs, an intelligently engaged America. And only an intelligent and eloquent and intelligent president can help the American public to understand these dilemmas.
Thank you so much, Professor Brzezinski.
Thank you very much.
That's Zbigniew Brzezinski, whose new book, Strategic Vision, America and the Crisis of Global Power, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. The story of Edward VIII of England and Wallace Simpson is one that continues to fascinate so many of us so many years after the great scandal that captured headlines around the world. There's an important new book. It's called That Woman, The Life of Wallace Simpson, Duchess of Windsor. It's by an excellent biographer, Anne Seba, reviewed for us by Liesl Schillinger, who says that woman acquires the propulsive energy of a thriller as it advances through Wallace's life. And I'm delighted that Anne Seba is here to talk about her book and Wallace Simpson. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So that woman maybe wasn't really the scheming villainess so many have assumed she was.
Well, she's no saint. Let's put it in perspective. If you play with fire, you get burnt. But I do think I've turned the story on its head, because up until now, everyone assumed that she was the one who lured Edward from his throne And I think what I've shown by these new letters that I've found is that actually she was the hunted, not the hunter. He was the one who couldn't possibly live without her. When she tried to leave him, too late, of course, he threatened to slit his throat.
So let's get to the beginning of the story. How did these two very different people meet? Where did they meet? When was it? What were the circumstances?
Okay. 1928, Wallace comes to London, married to an Anglo-American shipping company owner called Ernest Simpson. They live in London, and she soon moves in the circle of Thelma Furness, who is the king's current mistress. And at that point, the Prince of Wales, Edward VIII as he became, loves everything American. I mean, these often very ephemeral things like trouser turn-ups, painted fingernails, jazz and the telephone, but he really likes American women. So Thelma is half American, and to amuse the king, she meets Wallace and thinks, oh, perhaps Wallace will amuse the king too. And the first time they meet, Wallace and Ernest are actually invited to Melton Mowbray as chaperones.
And tell us about the kind of woman Wallace Simpson was then. Was she beautiful? Was she smart? Stylish? Was this someone who might very well catch the eye of the Prince
you
of Wales?
You wouldn't think so, would you? And that's why nobody's understood this story. Because up until now, everyone's always said, what was it about this woman? Not conventionally beautiful in a sort of English rose, blue-eyed, blonde manner. So not conventionally beautiful, middle-aged, not particularly smart, clever, no money. What was it that he found so alluring? So because nobody can explain it, they say, ah, she must have bewitched him. She must have learnt sexual tricks in China. Now, she was in China in 1924 to 25 after her first marriage to a naval aviator had broken up, Wynne Spencer. And when it broke up, she'd gone out to visit him. He was serving in the Far East, and she couldn't get a divorce, and her uncle had threatened to cut her off if she got a divorce because it would bring shame on the Warfield family. So she was really wasting time wondering what to do. She called it in her autobiography, my lotus year. She said, well, life was so good, too good for a woman, which is an extraordinary phrase. I think what she means is she was able to lead a sexually liberated life at a time when most women couldn't possibly dream of it because of fear of getting pregnant, contraception barely existed. So Wallace wanders around China. She goes from Shanghai to Peking for a year, and it's said that because of that year, she learnt these sexual tricks, and Queen Mary, who later became her mother-in-law, and Baldwin, the British Prime Minister, apparently compiled a China dossier. Now, nobody's ever found
it. So this is really true. They said that she had bewitched him with sexual tricks she'd learned in China?
Of course, because they couldn't believe that this woman could have lured such a handsome, charming prince from the throne. Now, once you see that actually he was a very troubled young man, that I don't believe he really wanted the throne. He would have taken it in circumstances with Wallace by his side as a sort of domineering, controlling mother figure. I think he would have carried on with his duties as monarch. The date for the coronation was set. But if he couldn't have Wallace, he really didn't want the throne. And it's very clear looking at his letters to a previous mistress, Frieda Dudley Ward, also half American, of course, that actually he said to Frieda that he thought the days of monarchy were over. He said if he couldn't have the throne with her by her side in the way that he wanted it, he'd rather die. So he expressed suicidal wishes much earlier on. This is in the early 1920s.
Now, you mentioned the important letters you found. How did you find them, and where did you find them?
I can't tell you who owns them. I can tell you a little bit about my trail, because it really is a biographer's gold dust to find these new letters. 15 letters from Wallace to Ernest, tied up in string with the envelopes and the postmarks, which really reveal that Wallace never wanted to be queen. And
You mean she would have given him up? She would have given the marriage
up? She wanted to give Edward up. She really never expected it to go this far. The relationship with Edward was while he was Prince of Wales. She always assumed that when he became king, she wouldn't be allowed to carry on, that somebody younger, more beautiful would be found. And she'd just go back to Ernest, who was her safety net, with a few jewels, memories. Deeply insecure is what you have to realise about Wallis. She grew up without a father. Her father died when she was only a couple of months old. And that knowledge that the Warfields were outsiders was what really scarred her. She always thought that she needed to have some sort of security from a man, and this was really giving her a leg up in society and plenty of jewellery. Now, you asked, how did I find the letters? I decided that the one character in this story who really was one-dimensional, unbelievably flat, and that was where I should start my research, was Ernest Simpson. How do you really explain that a man allowed his wife to be taken up as mistress of the Prince of Wales? It just didn't make any sense. So I did the obvious thing. I Googled him. I did a Wikipedia search on Ernest Simpson. And at the bottom of the Wikipedia article, it said that Ernest Simpson was married four times. I mean, a less likely man to be married four times. And that with his third wife, Mary Kirk, who was Wallace's best friend from school, and Wallace manipulated her into this relationship, he'd had a son born in 1939, and that this son was now a free diving instructor in Mexico by the name of Aaron Solomons. Well, if that doesn't ring alarm bells, you know, what does? So I then Googled Aaron Solomons, a free diving instructor in Mexico, and I found the free diver's web and a picture of him and a phone number. He was utterly shocked. No one had ever traced him before, which I find amazing. He invited me out to Mexico. I went to stay with a strange man in the Mexican desert. And we spent 4 days talking about Wallis, whom he never met, but who he felt had completely damaged his life, and about his father, Ernest Simpson, a man he really hated. He was not the source of the letters. He doesn't own a thing, but he did introduce me to about 20 relations, distant relations, friends of relations, all over England and America, and I saw every one. And it was the 19th who said to me, "Oh, by the way, I've got some letters. Would you like to see them?" I said, "Yes, please."
It's so gratifying to hear you describe this, and I'm a biographer myself, and sometimes readers don't understand, or listeners to this podcast, how much of it really is a kind of hunt, and then there are certain moments when sort of the nut of the story is cracked open for you. What was it like for you when you got those letters and read them? Did it open up new vistas for you in the story you were telling?
Immediately. As soon as she brought these out, I just knew it was groundbreaking. There are many things in these letters that need to be explained. First of all, there was a reference between Wallis and Ernest to Edward as Peter Pan, the boy who wouldn't grow up. That, to me, was the most extraordinary, because Wallis recognised what a troubled young man he was, who was looking for a mother figure, and she knew that she was going to be saddled with this adolescent, really. And the private ridicule between Wallis and Ernest is extraordinary. Edward, up until now, has always been referred to in popular culture as the man who gave up everything, throne and empire, for the woman he loved. And here you have the woman he loved ridiculing him behind his back. Now, the other thing about these letters, it shows that Wallace's love for Ernest was a really deep-seated love. She used, they used the term congenial. And in some of the letters she says, "I can't believe how this could have happened to two people who got along so well." So it was a sort of deep-seated love, not a passionate, lustful, youthful love, but they really understood each other. And I think Wallis could not believe that she had lost Ernest, a man who really did understand her. She had this sort of grasping ambition and, on the other hand, desperate fragility and fear. And she covered this up by this need for money or need for jewellery. Jewellery was the really corrosive element in this whole story.
Thanks so much, Anne.
Thank you so much. It's great to be in America.
That was Anne Seba, whose book, That Woman, The Life of Wallis Simpson, Duchess of Windsor, is reviewed in the New York Times Book Review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, on the nonfiction side, there's a new book at number 11 called Soldier Dogs by Maria Gudovich, talking about the role that dogs play in the military. Everything else new on both sides of the list is all the way up at the top of the lists. On the nonfiction side, there's Rachel Maddow's Drift, which talks about the expansion of the military and the security apparatus in the country.
At which we reviewed.
We review it in the April 15th issue, I think. Then Hank Haney has a book called The Big Miss. He's a golf coach, and he spent 6 years as Tiger Woods' coach, so he's talking about that in this book. Then over on the fiction side, there's a book at number 5 called Elegy for Eddie by Jacqueline Winspear. And then new books at number 1, 2, and 3. Danielle Steele is at number 3 with a book called Betrayal, another Hollywood book. Number 2, James Patterson and his co-writer David Ellis have a book called Guilty Wives.
I think I've heard of David Ellis, but who's the other guy?
Number 1 is J.R. Ward, who is a romance writer. Under the name J.R. Ward, she writes paranormal romances. She also writes other books under other pseudonyms. This one's a paranormal romance called Lover Reborn. J.R. Ward and James Patterson and Danielle Steele all fall into kind of the brand name author. They debuted right at the top of the list, probably because they have such a built-in readership already. And I talked to a guy this week for the column named James Hall, who's a mystery writer, who's just written a book called Hitlit, looking at how books make the bestseller list, and especially what accounts for kind of the mega bestsellers, the books that just tap a chord and go on to sell millions of copies.
And his book is a serious thing, his investigation of all this, right? He's kind of a scholar.
He is kind of a scholar. He's taught at Florida International University, which is part of the state system down in Florida, for decades, for something like 30 years. He started out as a postmodern scholar, and he wanted to be a postmodern writer himself. He kept trying to write like a Stanley Elkin or Thomas Pynchon type novel, kind of the goofy comic postmodernist stuff that was big back in the 60s. And he was really struggling with it. And so he said, you know, I'm going to look and see what books sell and what elements they have in common. And he started with like Gone with the Wind and some of these books that had become really big bestsellers. He eventually started a class out of this, a class in bestselling literature. So he's a professor of literature and a professor of creative writing.
So his class was not a how-to course on how to do it so much as really an analysis or investigation of the phenomenon of the bestseller?
That's right. But what's interesting is that a number of his students who took that class went on to become bestselling writers themselves. One of them, probably the most famous name who took that class with him was Dennis Lehane from Mystic River and a number of other bestsellers. So this class, yes, it's an analysis of what elements it takes for a novel to tap into the public consciousness like that.
Any surprises?
Well, no, not a lot of surprises. The three biggest elements are a maverick hero, somebody who's kind of operating outside of normal society, very high stakes, kind of intensifying danger in a short time period so that you just have something pulling you through the pages. And hot sex.
Oh, no wonder Ulysses topped the bestseller list all those years.
He did also find some political elements that these things tap into the American story somehow, that they reinforce our idea of ourselves as Americans and tap into bigger social struggles. Race often plays a role in these books. He talks about To Kill a Mockingbird. And also a look at like secret societies, whether it's the plantation in To Gone with the Wind, or in the Da Vinci Code, this whole kind of
Opus Dei.
Yeah, exactly.
So has he applied this knowledge himself and written some mega bestsellers?
Well, it's funny. Um, he, he has had a number of bestsellers, not on the Times list, but in other national lists. He's had USA Today bestsellers and San Francisco Chronicle. His books have hit the list there. He gave up trying to write postmodern novels, and he started writing a series of mysteries. And a number of them were optioned for movies, and again, they were bestsellers. But I asked him about that. I said, you know, you've studied all this. You have all this knowledge as you sit down to write your books. How come you've never written the multi-million bestseller? And he said, it's the one question I'm just bracing myself for as this book comes out, is how come I'm not a household name? He said, so much of it is just luck, too. You never know, you know, what's going to hit at the right moment for the culture.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.